has earned the affection, the respect, the admiration of the entire Jewish community, which is not easy to do in a place like L.A., because he serves as the chaplain at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, Cedars-Sinai Hospital. And in that capacity, he takes care of not just people of every faith, but people of every Jewish faith, the entire Jewish community. And everyone in the Jewish community knows that this is a man who deeply cares, who brings his faith and his spirituality with him into every encounter with patients and with healers, and has brought a great deal of spirit and love to that job, has earned our respect. And we're really honored to have Jason with us tonight to talk to us about his conversations with God. Please welcome Rabbi Jason Weiner.
There you go. Thank you.
All Jews, what a gift. Can you imagine? There you go.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Well, thank you. It's really an honor to be in this incredible synagogue. This is a synagogue that I've looked up to and respected for many years. And your rabbi, I don't have to tell you, but Rabbi Feinstein is truly one of a kind and someone who I just adore. And so you're all so lucky to be members of such an incredible synagogue and to have a rabbi who's such a unique mensch and scholar. So thank you very much for having me. And thank you, Rabbi Feinstein, for the invitation. You know, as Rabbi Feinstein pointed out, it's kind of a unique role being a rabbi in a hospital. Not everyone really understands what a rabbi is supposed to do in a hospital. Technically, my title is chaplain. So oftentimes, I'll walk into a patient's room and I'll say something like, "Hi, I'm the chaplain here." And the patients will say to me, "Well, don't try with us, buddy. We're Jewish. You're not going to convert us." So I realize, okay, maybe I should say I'm a rabbi. But oftentimes I'll walk into Jewish and the rabbi and they say, "Oh, no, it's okay. You can stay in the kitchen and supervise the kitchen. We don't need you to check on us." They think that I'm, you know, supervising the kitchen. It reminds me, as we speak about conversations with God, that, you know, when I first started, one time I got a call to a patient that they wanted the rabbi. "Rabbi, please come up and bring chicken." So I thought, okay, they think that I'm the supervisor of the kitchen. So I guess I'll just go and explain to them. So it's easier that way. So I walk in the room and I said, "Hi, you know, I'm the rabbi here." They said, "Yeah, rabbi, did you bring the chicken?" So I said, "No, I was going to explain to you. I don't do that." And they said, "Well, what kind of a rabbi are you?" So I tried to explain to them and they wouldn't hear of it. They said, "No, where's our chicken?" So I said, "Okay, fine. You know what? I'll just get the chicken. What's the big deal? Do you want barbecue or roasted chicken? What would you like?" And they looked at me like I was crazy. They said, "Rabbi, what do you mean? We don't want a barbecue roasted. We want a live chicken. Bring us a chicken." So I thought, No, I can't bring you a chicken in the hospital. What do you need a chicken for?" So they said, "Don't you know, Rabbi, you're supposed to take the chicken, put it on the part of your body that is not well. The chicken will absorb your illness. And then you shech the chicken, kill the chicken, and then you're cured. You never heard of that before, Rabbi?" No, I never heard of it either. So, you know, I had to kind of explain to them, "I think I'm a real rabbi, but I'm sorry, I can't do this for you." It was not too long later that I was visiting a patient, and he says to me, the son of the patient walks out of the room and says, "What are you doing here, Rabbi?" So I said, "Oh, I'm just here to visit." He says, "You know, no offense, but a hospital is a place for doctors, and a synagogue is a place for rabbis. We don't need you here." So I said, "You know, actually, I'm honored that you think at least the synagogue is a place for rabbis. Please come tell my congregants that, because some of them don't agree with you." But it was interesting because a few weeks later, he calls me and he says, "You know, Rabbi, maybe we could use a visit." So I went, he had in the room at that time when I came in, a Zohar, you know, the book of Kabbalah. And I remember I said to him, "You know, a hospital's not a place for a rabbi, but it's a place for a Zohar." He says, "Rabbi, we're getting desperate. We got desperate." He says, "We've done everything. We changed the patient's name. We've given tzedakah. We're saying psalms. We killed a chicken." I was like, "Oh my gosh, I don't know what's going on here. But hopefully I can help in some way. But chicken killing is not going to be my specialty." And so that's what I wanted to start talking about with you a little bit tonight. What role does God play in illness? And really also what I wanted to share with you is my personal journey. I've been at Cedars-Sinai for 11 years now. And I have to be honest that my kind of theology, the way I see God and the way I interact with God, has changed in that time in the hospital. I don't see how it couldn't have, given how I started out. And I'll share with you a little bit of that journey. And maybe I'll share with you by sharing a story.
Cognitive impairment is extremely common and all too often goes undiagnosed. An estimated 11% of adults over the age of 45 have subjective cognitive symptoms, meaning they perceive changes in their ability to think and remember. These concerns should be investigated seriously. Alzheimer's and other dementias are the top cause of disabilities in later life. Fortunately, recent studies show early detection and intervention could prevent or slow up to 40% of dementia cases and reduce the costs by up to 25%. That's why primary care physicians need a way to quickly assess, confidently diagnose, and easily plan care for patients' cognitive health and get compensated for it. They need BrainCheck. BrainCheck's rapid, reliable cognitive health technology is designed for everyday clinical use. It gives clinicians meaningful data to assess, analyze, and act on their patients' cognitive concerns earlier and more effectively than ever. Here's how it works. When a patient or caregiver expresses a concern about memory loss or cloudy thinking, or if their doctor has a concern, a technician can administer a BrainCheck assessment in clinic, or it can be completed by the patient securely at home. Our standard battery consists of 5 gold standard assessments, and it takes about 15 minutes. Once complete, clinicians can immediately access our detailed clinical report, which includes an overall score and individual scores for each cognitive domain, as well as clinical decision support to help doctors diagnose with confidence and track cognitive changes over time. If there is a cognitive concern, BrainCheck's Cortex platform includes tools to streamline creation of a personalized cognitive care plan, which can include additional follow-up or referral to a specialist. With BrainCheck, clinicians can increase access to cognitive care, improve the quality of care, and get properly compensated. Want to know more? Schedule a demo with a member of our team.
The story that was maybe most impactful for me in that journey. Without giving away, you know, too many details, one time there was a patient who was very sick, but we were hopeful for her recovery. And her parents, she was going into surgery, and so her parents asked me if during surgery we could go into our chapel, to the synagogue at the hospital, and pray. You know, it was a risky surgery. So we got down there, and I said, what kind of prayer should we say? And they said, well, we should say a Mishaberach, right, a healing prayer. And all the psalms that are like healing psalms, and every prayer that you know that is related to healing. So we said healing prayers and psalms and Mishaberach. You know, we did the whole traditional Mishaberach and Debbie Friedman's Mishaberach, right? Every version we could think of, and that's what they wanted. And then I got a call on my cell phone informing me that we were going to have to give the family of this patient very, very bad news. And so we did. And unfortunately, it turns out that while we were praying for their loved one, She had died. And it was very shocking. We really weren't expecting her to die, even though we knew it was very risky. And then they kind of went into a horrible mourning and shock. And I didn't really see them again until the Shiva. I went to visit them at Shiva. It's one of those moments that, you know, I drive by where they live on a regular basis. And it's been 10 years since this happened. And every single time I drive by their street, their family flashes into my mind again, the crying and the pain. And when I walked into the Shiva house, it was a young person who had died, and as you can imagine, there was hundreds of people in the house and all the friends and family. And I walk into the house and I see the parents across the way, you know, and the father sees me and kind of jets right at me in the Shiva house and kind of makes a parting of the sea and makes his way through the people. He comes right at me in my face, and we had been very close, and I think I tried to help them, and it was a very warm relationship. And he goes over to me in front of everyone, and he says to me, Rabbi, your prayers didn't work. And it was probably the low point of my rabbinic career. I mean, I felt horrible. What can you say? And I felt so bad for him. I mean, I didn't say a word, obviously. I just kind of gave him a hug, and he hugged me back. I kind of walked him back to where he was sitting, and then I left, you know, after a few minutes. And I walked out of there like in this kind of depression. Like, maybe I failed as a rabbi, as a chaplain. I set them up for expectations of healing and recovery, miraculous cure, and it didn't happen. And then they were so let down. And what role did prayer play? That we, you know, we sat in the chapel praying, pouring our hearts out. You know, Rabbi Levi Meir of blessed memory was my predecessor at Cedar Sinai. When I first came to Cedars to fill in for him, he was sick at the time. I said to him, "Do you have like a daily minion here?" He said, he looked at me like, "Daily minion? What? No, we have an hourly minion here." I was like, "Really? Wow, this is a really Jewish hospital." He said, "Yeah, at every moment, there's a guarantee there's a minion of people praying in this hospital. Maybe not all together in the chapel saying the traditional prayers, but there's always a minion of people praying." It's, you know, and I started to think, rethink the whole thing. Like, did our prayers actually hurt them more? And as I began to think about it, my kind of style, for better or for worse, maybe for worse, is that I kind of intellectualize things, and I started to research. And I started to think, like, maybe let me look into, like, Jewish law and Jewish tradition and Talmudic texts to see maybe I did something wrong. And the first thing I came across is the Mishnah. What I'm going to do is I'm going to refer to sources on your page here, but I think to save time, I'm going to just kind of reference them, but you have them in front of you so you could read them. But I might read a line or two just to get you the taste of them. But this way we can kind of cover more ideas instead of just analyzing the text. But you have it. There's a Mishnah in the Talmud and Brachot. It's a famous Mishnah. The Mishnah is, imagine the following ethical scenario. Imagine, this is a classic ethics scenario. Imagine you're driving home from work at the end of the day, you're driving up your street, and you see dozens of ambulances and fire trucks and police cars down the block near your house. Is it proper to say, "Oh, please God, I hope it's not my house"?
Millions of people struggle with mental health challenges, and it's time to break the stigma and start talking about it.
To learn about someone else who's had different experiences than you. We have such access to other people.
On this channel, we aim to provide a safe and supportive community for anyone seeking help with their mental health.
Because it's all happening in this area. All of it.
In a way, that's what most of us would do, right? But in a way, what you are saying is, I hope it's my neighbor's house. I mean, that's not very nice. And so the Talmud actually gives that example. It says, "Hatzoik l'sha'avar," if you pray for something that's already determined. The other example it gives is, if a woman is pregnant and you pray for the sex of the child. Once someone's pregnant, there's already, it's already there. You could look at an ultrasound. Especially today, I guess they couldn't do that then, but it was already determined. There's a gender inside, you just can't see it. So it doesn't make sense to pray for the sex of the child when it's already there, even though you can't see it. So the Talmud says that is what's called a tefillat shav, a prayer in vain. And it's improper to say a prayer for something that has already happened. It can't come true. It's already, why pray for something that's already there? And so as I researched, I even found that there were some great rabbis throughout history that when people would come to them and say, "Rabbi, my loved one is very sick. Please, will you gather a prayer gathering or say a Misha Beirach prayer for them?" The rabbis would say, "I'm sorry, no. If it's a certain level of illness or certain expectations the doctors have, there's a tradition amongst some rabbis that if you would pray for them, and it's most likely not going to happen, what they're praying for, the doctors have already said there's no hope, let's say, that what would happen to people's emunah, to people's faith, if they're constantly praying for something and it's not coming true? What do you think would happen? They lose faith. So these rabbis felt, you know what, it's improper. It's actually maybe sometimes wrong to pray for something that's unlikely to happen. So I read that and I thought, you know what? He was right, this patient's father. I was wrong. I made a mistake. We shouldn't have prayed for her. And I felt really bad about it. And I also felt unsatisfied. Because I don't know about you when you hear me say this, but when I first read this, I thought, I don't know, can that really be the final answer, though? Should we not pray for people? If they're very sick, I don't know, it feels like uncompassionate or something about it just feels like unspiritual. I don't know what. It just didn't feel like satisfying to me. So I continued to research. And I came across a work here, the second source there, Toldot Yaakov. It's a biography of one of the rabbis, one of the great rabbis of the last 100 years in Israel. It was known as the Stipler. They called him the Stipler Gaon. That was his title. And he wrote a book about this. And he actually argued that it's never wrong to pray. He gives five reasons here. five reasons that it's always appropriate to pray. He says, for example, even if a person can't be cured, you never know. Maybe by praying for them, they'll suffer a little bit less. Maybe it'll have some kind of an impact. Or he says, maybe it will help them live a little bit longer. And he argues that living a little bit longer, there's value to that, and so that's a good thing. Or he says there that, maybe a miracle will happen. There have been times when things happen that were unexpected, and, who knows? Maybe this will be the micro, the fraction of a percent of chance of a time that the person will recover. So maybe it's dependent on your prayers. Or he says, maybe it will be like a source of merit for them, so that when they go to the next world, the fact that people prayed for them will kind of help them in some way. Or his last theory is that even if it doesn't help that person, maybe it will help other people somehow. I remember when I was a kid, I don't remember the name of this person, but there was an Israeli soldier who was captured and was being held hostage. But no one knew if he was alive or dead or how he's being treated. And in the schools, everyone was praying for this person. And I remember we were praying for him. And then it came out in the news that he was dead already. He had been killed. And I remember watching the funeral. I remember watching it together as kids. We were watching it in class. And the mother of the patient, of the soldier, said, "I want to say a word to all of Klal Yisrael, all the Jewish people around the world who are praying for my son. You might be disappointed now. You might feel hurt that your prayers weren't answered." She said, "I want you to know that while this was happening, there was a helicopter crash in the Golan. 16 soldiers were on that helicopter. When they saw it go down, they thought everyone was going to die. They all lived," she said. She said, "I think for whatever reason, God directed your prayers to those soldiers, and you saved their life." So she said, "I don't want you to lose faith." This is what she said. I would have never imposed such an ideology on someone, but this is what was comforting her at the time. So this was the idea that he proposes there, the last idea, that somehow maybe God takes the prayers and then God answers them in whatever way God sees fit. So that was his theory, what the Stipler. He says, no, you should always pray. Always pray. You never know in what way it will have an impact, but it will have some kind of an impact. So I read that. It's kind of the opposite of the first approach. The first approach was saying, don't pray for something that is unlikely to happen because you'll lose faith. It's a prayer in vain. It's not appropriate. It's praying for a miracle. But he says, no, pray. So I read that and I thought, well, maybe I did do the right thing with this family. Maybe it's good that we prayed, and who knows, maybe it helped her in some ways. Maybe she suffered less. Maybe it's helping her in heaven, in some way. Who knows? So now I don't know. But then I thought, still, I don't know. There's no nuance here. It's like he's saying, always just pray. And this family was hurt. The father was upset at me. He felt that we shouldn't have prayed in those cases. He wasn't prepared for the shocking outcome. So I still wasn't totally at ease. So I continued to research. And one day, I actually remember where I was sitting. I was sitting at Children's Hospital, where I was doing my CPE, my clinical pastoral education training, at Children's Hospital in Hollywood. And I, during my lunch break, I was reading books on theology, trying to figure out, how to understand all the suffering I was seeing in the world and what that means that there's a good God and yet horrible suffering. And I came across this quote on the bottom of page one here. In fact, maybe this will even read because it's short. This is what Rabbi Soloveitchik from Yeshiva University said. He said, "We have the assurance that God is indeed a shomea tefillah," which means one who hears our prayers. "But not necessarily that God is a mekabel tefillah, one who accepts our prayers and accedes to our specific requests. Of course, it's our persistent hope that our requests will be fulfilled, but it's not our primary motivation for prayer. In praying, we do not seek a response to a particular request as much as we desire a fellowship with God." Rabbi Soloveitchik's argument was that the purpose of prayer is not to ask God to do things for us. I think, I don't remember who it was, who said that God is not our butler, right? It's not that God is supposed to be doing things for us. We're not supposed to be asking God to, accomplish tasks for us. But the goal of prayer is to develop a connection, a relationship, a spirituality, a closeness to God. We do ask God for things. We're hoping that God will do things, but God's way beyond anything we can imagine. So we don't expect God to do things for us. We just pray to develop the relationship. And once we have a relationship, we have a concept of Imo Anochi Batsara, I'm with you in your pain. God can be, developing a relationship can help kind of inoculate us for difficult times. And so, you know, some people say, like as a joke, I don't think it's funny, but it's like I've heard this joke where people say things like, you know, why didn't God answer my prayer? So the response is, God did answer your prayer, but the answer was no. So I've heard people say things like that a lot, and sometimes people think that would be comforting. Personally, I don't find that comforting. Because sometimes I see, and we all see, we experience in our world horrific tragedies, tremendous suffering. And I can't imagine God saying no to a request to help these people. What kind of a God would say no? And I don't know if I could pray to a God who would say no to people who are suffering intractably, children who are suffering, parents who are suffering. Why would God say no to that? I think, actually, once I read this piece and started to understand it, that it's not that not that God says no. Rather, I say to people, God is with you when you're saying the prayer. God hears our prayers. It changes what it means. What we mean by saying, is prayer effective? Someone asked me once, is prayer effective? So I said, yes, I think prayer is very effective. So they said, yeah, but if you pray for the lottery, are you going to win the lottery? If you pray for the Rams to win, are the Rams going to win Sunday? If you pray for someone to get miraculously cured, are they going to get cured? So I said, yeah, no, definitely not. Definitely not. So he said, oh, so you see, prayer is not effective. So I said, well, let's change what we mean by the definition of effective. If what we mean by the purpose of prayer is to change an outcome, you're right, prayer is not effective. But if the purpose of prayer is to have an impact on my own connection to God, my ability to cope with difficult times, prayer can be very effective if it develops a relationship, a worldview where I feel like I have a connection, a support system, an ideology where I can understand things in a certain way. So when people say to me things like, does God answer prayers? So my answer becomes, I believe that God hears our prayers. God is with us when we pray. We couch it a little bit differently. So where does this idea, so what does that mean though? Someone just said to me this week, someone whose baby is very, very sick. So the parent said to me, holding this beautiful, pure, innocent child, my one question, Rabbi, my one question is, how could a good God do this to a pure, innocent baby? So the way I deal with this, if we turn the page, there is a wild story in the Talmud, which is kind of has become the way I see the world. It had to change a lot since I've been at the hospital. The story in the Talmud is about Vespasian. This is on the top of page 2 there. The Roman emperor, who was the one who commanded the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. This was a very a horrible, traumatic experience for the Jewish people. You imagine the center of Jewish life, the center of the Jewish world, was not just Jerusalem, it was this building, the temple. For over 400 years, the focus of the religion was on this temple. The religion is based in this temple, and when the Romans came to destroy it, they had a lot of fun destroying it. Let's put it that way. It wasn't just like, you know, Jews, we're closing your temple down, you have to move to Babylon. It was more like, or actually at that time it was moving all over to Spain. This was the second temple. So they moved to Babylon, North Africa, Spain, Turkey, Germany. And they ridiculed, mocked the Jews. So what this Vespasian did basically was he went into the Holy of Holies, which is this place where only the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, could go once a year. On the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur. He would have to spend the whole day beforehand preparing himself. There was a belief traditionally that if he wasn't properly prepared, that he would die from going in there because of the holiness would overwhelm him. The holiest place where no one could go in except for this one person. Vespasian goes in and spreads out a Torah scroll in the place. So now we have our holy Torah scroll. If a Torah scroll falls on the ground, we fast. He spreads out a Torah scroll and basically rapes a woman on top of it. There's the most horrific act in the most holy place on top of a Torah scroll. The most disgusting, shocking thing possible. And then he mocks the Jews and says, look what I just did. Where's the lightning? Why didn't they get struck down by lightning? Look, Jews, your God doesn't care. I defeated you, and I'm mocking you. So where was God at that time? You know what the rabbis say? This is shocking, but it's in the bottom of this source there in Gittin. The rabbi said, Abba Hanan Amar, Mi Chamocha Chasin Ka. Who is like you, O God? Mi Chamocha Chasin Vekasha. Who is like you, God? Who restrains yourself. Shata Shomea Niutso Vigidufo Sha'oto Rasha. You hear the despicable things of this horrible person? Vishotake. And you remain silent. He's praising God for having remained silent at that moment. And then he quotes the verse, Mi Chamocha Be'elim Hashem. You know, we say this in synagogue. Mi Chamocha, how's the song go? I'm horrible. Right, the Mi Chamocha. Who is like you, O God? Right? So he says, but he changes the word a little bit. Not Mi Chamocha Be'elohim, Mi Chamocha Be'elim, Be'elim. Who is like you amongst the deaf, the mute, the people that don't speak? Who is like you who keeps your mouth shut? Ilmim, Elaim, mute. So what he's saying, what the Talmud is saying there is that God holds God's self back. I'll say it more clearly in this next source. The Meshe Chachma, one of the great rabbis of Eastern Europe in the last 200 years, a philosopher, a thinker, there's a big controversy, a big discussion in Jewish thought about what does it mean to be created in the image of God? B'Tzelem Elokim. We're all created in the image of God. All human beings. Jew, non-Jew, everybody. What does that mean? Lots of theories on that. His argument, if we look in what I underlined there, both in the Hebrew and the English, it says, we as humans can't understand God. If we knew God, we would be God. Here's what we know. The image of God is that in the giving us free will, that God withdrew God's self from the world. God restrained God's self to give us free will. God left space for us to do what we would choose. And God left space and openness for the world to function and for us to make the best of it. That's why God said, that's what it means. God gave us free will, true free will, because God said, I'm pulling back. I'm allowing the world to function, and I hope you don't mess it up. So what the rabbis were saying, when Vespasian, when this horrible person came and tried to desecrate the temple, and God didn't strike him down with lightning, was that God has decided... I don't give a damn about my reputation.
I hope my children see in me a fighter, a person who's going to step up.
That God cares, God loves us, but God has also decided to allow the world to go, Olam kemenhago noheg, as the Talmud says, to go according to its own free will, and God sits back, sometimes crying. Probably that day God was crying. That's what we believe, whatever that means in godly terms. So what did I say to this poor mother who said to me, I love God, I believe in God, but how could God do this to a pure innocent child? So, the way I see it, first of all, I don't debate theology with patients. I mean, I'm not going to start arguing with her and showing her Talmudic sources. Obviously, I listen to her. I cry with her. I try to help her emote and express what she's feeling. I'm not there to try to convince people of anything. But after talking for a little bit, she finally said to me, so what's your answer? What do you say? How could God do this? I said, well, here's how I asked the question. How does God allow it to happen? I don't believe God did it. I don't believe God does this to children. I don't believe God does this to adults. I don't believe God inflicts horrible harm and suffering on people. I believe that God has made the decision, for whatever reason that's beyond us, to allow the world to function. And sometimes things happen that are very bad. And God, for whatever reason, it's way beyond us to understand, allows that to happen. The thing is that I believe a couple of things that come for me. One is that I do believe that God can intervene. This is where I would differ from, for example, Rabbi Harold Kushner on this. If you're familiar with his theology, it's not that different than what I've been saying so far in some ways. Rabbi Kushner, when bad things happen to good people, his argument was basically that, like when a person writes a novel, his question was, I mean, just to make sure we're on the same page, I know that many of you are familiar with this, was that how could a God be good and all-powerful and all-knowing? If God is all-powerful and good, then why would God let bad things happen? So he argued that, like when someone writes a novel, sometimes it kind of takes on a life of its own. The world has taken on a life of its own, and God can't intervene anymore. It kind of spun into its own way. So the only different thing that I say about that is not that God can't. From my perspective, I can't use the words God and can't in the same sentence. But I would say God doesn't. God can, but made the decision that God does not. Could there sometimes be miracles that impact the whole world? Personally, I believe that there might have been sometimes. I personally, I'll just share an example. I believe that in 1948, there was a miracle. Founding the state of, I believe that was a miracle. I believe that there are some times when God has intervened to make miracles. But in general, God said, I stay out of it. However, I do believe, and with this I'll begin to wrap up, I do believe that God cares, is with us, and in the end, there is justice. I believe in an afterlife. I believe that somehow things end up working out. And the truth is, this is, you know, the Talmud itself answers the question of why do bad things happen to good people. It gives an answer. Some people often say, well, we don't know. There's so many different, the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, ethics of our fathers, ethics of our ancestors. Rabbi Inai Omar, this is on the bottom of page 2. Ein biyadeinu lo mishalva tarishayim v'af lo misurat tzadikim. We are not capable of comprehending neither the prosperity of the wicked nor the suffering of the righteous. It's just simply not in our power. And the truth is, I think it would be in some ways unethical to give an answer. First of all, I believe, as I'm trying to express, that God is so far beyond human capacity to comprehend, that's what I love about God. It reminds me of a time when, you know, as I said, my job as a chaplain is not really to give theological answers, it's to listen to people, to help to empower them, to find their own voice. I remember one time, this is also going way back when I first started, it was also about 10, 11 years ago, I got called in late at night. A family told the nursing office, you know, we need the rabbi as soon as possible. I remember I showed up. Patient had just been diagnosed with a horrible illness. I walk in the room, there's family kind of gathered outside, and they said, Rabbi, we just called you for one reason. We got bad news tonight, we want to know why. Why does God allow bad things happen to good people? So, I remember I said, I don't know. And they said, okay, is there another rabbi we can speak to? And they turned to the nurse right then. Nurse, can you get a different rabbi? I was like, I'm sorry, if you want, I'm happy to discuss. I actually meant that in a positive way. What I mean when I say I don't know is I believe I can't know. I believe God is great and God is beyond our ability to comprehend. We are human. We are finite. I heard once from Rabbi Wolpe, actually, this great mashal. I thought it was brilliant. He said, we know this today. We know today that we can't see every color that's in the spectrum, right? There are things that our eyes, there are colors that our eyes aren't picking up. We know that there are sounds that our ears don't pick up. Like imagine a doggy whistle, for example. A dog might be going crazy and we don't even hear a sound. There are sounds our ears don't pick up. Isn't it therefore logical to assume if we can't see some things and we can't hear some things, that there are some things we can't think of, we can't imagine? Like the classic question of, like, you know, if you just go straight up, at what point in outer space will you get to the end? There has to be an end somewhere. It doesn't have to end somewhere. But it can't. But infinity is hard for a human. What happened before day one when God created the world? What was before that? What was God doing? There has to be something before then. But we just can't. Infinity. So I believe that God is too great. I also believe that we are here. If God purposely pulled back and gave us space in the world to make it, to act, therefore we have a mission in the world. We're supposed to make the world a better place, right? So if I could come here and tell you why bad things happen to good people, or not bad, good people, why bad things happen to anybody, if I could go in that hospital room and say, oh, you know why that is? It's because he didn't give enough charity. He didn't give enough tzedakah. Oh, it's because he cheated on his taxes. How do you give some reason? Oh, because he voted for this person. You know, who knows what reason people come up with. Oh, that's the reason you're suffering. So if I would say that, what does that release me of? If I know, oh, you, this person that's suffering, they asked me for help, but they're only suffering because, you know, they didn't help a lady across the street or something like that. So now I don't have to help them, right? Because, oh, it's a punishment. It's your fault. So I believe that it's actually problematic to give reasons, because it then releases me of my responsibility to make a difference in the world. I have to say, I don't know why bad things happen. I can't imagine why. In fact, I can't imagine that it's intentional, that people deserve it. Therefore, I know the one thing I do know is that I have to try to make a difference, try to make the world better. And this kind of way of thinking, I understood from another story in the Talmud. The last story I put on the page, I just decided to throw it on there right before I came here tonight, and so I apologize that I didn't have time to translate it as well. The Talmud has a fascinating story, a story of a near-death experience. That's the story. It's one of those wild things. I have met a number of patients. I was even with a patient once who died and then came back and told us after what she experienced. So I don't know. These things are beyond us. I don't know. But the Talmud has a story of what happened once when there was a near-death experience. It says as follows right here on the bottom of page 2. Kihad Rav Yosef Bereder of Yeshua ben Levi. There was this rabbi named Joseph, the son of Joshua ben Levi. Chalash Visnagi. He got sick, and then he came back. Kihadar, when he came back, meaning back from being dead, Amar Le'avuha, his father said to him, "My Chazis, what did you see there? I got to know what it was like." So you know what he said? What it was like in the other world? Amar Le, exactly. Olam Hafuch Ra'iti. I saw an upside down world. The opposite. What we think is usually on the bottom is on top. What we think is on top is on bottom. It was the opposite of what we think. The way I always understood this is we think we understand things. We think we understand how the world works. We think we know what's right. We think we know what's wrong. Could you imagine showing up one day where it's like, oh, wow. Now it makes sense. Now this is, I couldn't have thought it. I couldn't have imagined this. Olam hafuch. It's like the opposite of what I would have thought. It's so much beyond my capacity to imagine. So the way I see it is that, and this is now, I'll try to now summarize it kind of in one sentence or paragraph, everything that I said. So the way I see it is, you know, this man was upset at me that we prayed. Should we have prayed? I think yes. Now I do pray with people. I don't think I made a mistake praying with him. I did make some mistakes. I've made a lot of mistakes, but I even made a mistake in that case. But it wasn't the fact that we prayed. I do think, in retrospect, that I didn't couch the prayers correctly. I took the bait and let that prayer gathering be, you know, a gung-ho prayers for miracles. Nothing but what we're going to experience is only good news, everything's going to be great, and God's going to answer our prayers. That probably was a mistake of me. I realized, instead, to couch prayers as, let's pray now for God's presence. That whatever happens, that God will be with us. That we develop a sense of perspective. That we turn to God and we ask that God kind of be with us at all times. And we develop a relationship, a connection. If we haven't had one in the past, it's not never too late to start feeling a sense of closeness, of spirituality, of God with us in our lives. Why does God let bad things happen? From my perspective, this is a decision, whatever that means, decision, that God has made. That, and this has been a change for me in my kind of theology as I've experienced lots of suffering in the world. It's a reality of our world. There's a lot of good in the world. There's more good in some ways because the good is in spite of the suffering. It's good that people choose. But I believe that God kind of made a decision that I'm allowing the world to run. The world is going to run. And I'm there, I care, but I'm not intervening. And one day, I will. One day, we'll make it right. People will one day come back to me. We'll connect again. I will reward the good. There will be a sense of, it will make sense one day. And it will all be just. But right now, for whatever reason that we can't fully understand, I mean, the Jewish theologians give kind of a taste of a reason that we're supposed to have free will, and we're supposed to earn it, something, whatever that means. For whatever reason, God has made this decision, and this is the way the world functions, and we have a glorious challenge of trying to take a world that's an imperfect place and make it a better place and do everything we can to be God-like and be God's agents, as it were, much in the way that your rabbi and your synagogue has done in this community. And I know, as I know, and I look around, I see a few familiar faces, as many of you and your families have done so much good for the world, in spite of the amount of suffering.
Find licensed pharmacists who are continuously trained to give the care you deserve.
A world of care is in store.
It's here, JCPenney Beauty, in select stores and at jcp.com/beauty.
This is all kind of the way I've developed to grapple with these. Does not give me complete peace. I'm not saying that now when I see suffering, now that I've developed this perspective, it's all fine. It all makes sense to me. I don't mind it anymore. I still struggle and suffer with it. And I have no doubt that if I'm back here in another 10 years, I'll probably say something a little different. But this is what my experiences and my encounter with Jewish texts has led me to. And I look forward to discussing it more in depth with you tonight.
Delighted to have everyone here tonight, and a very special welcome to Rabbi Jason Weiner from Cedars-Sinai. Thank you for sharing. I want to compliment you to begin with. The position you hold is a terribly difficult position because you're dealing with such a wide range of families, personalities, spiritualities, religious commitments within the Jewish community, beyond the Jewish community, to do it with the kind of grace that you do it with. And at the same time, to come here tonight and to say to us, look, I have this really difficult thing. I meet people in the most difficult, vulnerable moments of tragedy. And you don't know these people. By and large, if they're calling you or not calling me, it means they don't know you.
Right.
I mean, they're just dialing zero on the phone of the hospital and what did the guy say? Send another rabbi. I thought that was so funny, you know. Send me someone who has an answer to this question. And I really appreciate the way that you showed us how your own thinking evolved and how you came to this place of understanding and a place where you really came to understand, or at least you have a conviction about the efficacy of prayer, what prayer does and how prayer does change the circumstance, change the situation. For a patient who's suffering, for a family that's suffering. I want to ask you a few questions just to push you a little bit, if
sure.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You know, with deep respect. Okay. Many of you remember Rabbi Schulweis, who was my teacher and my predecessor. So, if I could mimic him for just a moment, okay. So he would ask you the following question. He would go back to the Soloveitchik text. So he would say, look. If you say, I prayed and God said no, okay, or in your language, God could change a circumstance but has chosen not to, okay, then the question is, what do you mean he could have done it and chosen not to? If I'm a bystander watching a crime being committed and I choose not to intervene, what does that say about my morality?
Mm-hmm.
To argue that God could change the circumstances, I mean, the horrible circumstance you mentioned of a child, of a baby, and God somehow chose not to? Well, what would we say about anyone who could have chosen to save a child and chose not to?
Right.
Wouldn't it be safer to simply say, God can't? Because then there's no moral judgment involved. The moment you say God could but didn't, don't you engage in a moral process which is highly questionable?
Right.
Is that okay to ask?
Yes, good question. Yeah, it's an excellent question, and it's one that I've thought about. Maybe it's a hang-up of me. Maybe it's a problem I have. I'm not comfortable using the words God can't together. I believe that God is all-powerful, and I would want to clarify a few things. So first of all, I do believe, as I said, that God can but doesn't intervene. And when I say that, I mean not just that God can, but God virtually never does. So it's not like God looks at the world and says, well, this time I'll intervene, this time I won't intervene. What I believe, and what I think I understand from some of the sources that we read together, is that God does not intervene. However, I wouldn't go so far as to say that God can't, because I believe that God can do anything, and very rarely, but sometimes has. Not that I know for a fact when God did or didn't. I also believe that as much as God, as horrible as it is when bad things happen, like to a child, as we mentioned, this is why I quoted like some of those concluding sources, like the upside down world. I do believe that God sees things in a bigger picture, and that somehow, some way, there is a logic to it that's just beyond us to comprehend, and that things will be made right somehow in the long run, in the world to come, something like that, that is beyond our capability to perceive now, but might be. And I'll conclude by saying, all of this is speculation, because when we talk about God, we're talking about something that I don't believe we can fully comprehend. So we try our best to get a feel for an answer, but I don't believe that we can really give a conclusive answer.
Okay, I'm gonna ask you with due respect yet another one. Again, if you say we can't comprehend, then isn't silence probably the best answer? Because if you say we can't comprehend, what you're saying is, look, I have these two realities. I don't want to say God can't, and on the other hand, by saying God can't, I put myself in a morally impossible situation. So I'm just going to back away and say, I don't know how to fix this.
Right.
Which seems to me to put religious people like you and me in a very difficult place. You know,
right.
Why would a person want to sign on to a faith that said, at the moment I need you the most, you suddenly are quiet, don't have anything to say to me? Is that a fair question?
Yeah, that's a fair question.
I do this with love. I want you to understand. He could ask me the same questions and we'd go backwards, and maybe someday
right.
we will. But as long as you're on the hot seat.
Yeah. And it helps me, too. I mean, like I said, I'm trying to struggle
with
this.
I appreciate it. That's why I ask them with deep love and
right.
respect.
I mean, you know, I don't... in terms of, I think you asked a couple of questions.
Yeah, I got a lot, yeah.
But in terms of, well, you know, why not keep quiet? First of all, I do want to emphasize again that, you know, with patients on the front lines, so to speak, I really, really try hard not to give answers. I'm not trying to answer things or tell people what to believe or how to, you know, I do believe, as I quoted, what I think is the answer that the Talmud gives, Ein be'adenu. It's not in our hands to understand. It's beyond us. So kind of what we did tonight was, it should be, that in a way could be exactly what Rabbi Feinstein, what you said. Why not say, I don't know, this is beyond me to understand. But are any of us able to kind of leave it at that? Is it possible to kind of just let it go and say, okay, I don't know, I'm just going to move on? So we try to give our best shot at like, well, here's a way that gives me a little bit of a taste of a comprehension, of understanding. And, you know, I don't believe that God is silent. Totally silent in these times. I do believe that God wants to provide a sense of comfort and support and camaraderie in a certain way. So I do believe that God is there with us,
right.
by our side, just not necessarily intervening.
Yeah. Okay. and then the last piece is this idea of, you know, you said, I do believe that somehow, someday, one day, all of this will be reconciled. So I'm interested in that belief, but what does that mean? Does that mean I put down my tools and my research and my medicine and just say, let the world take its course because God will one day reconcile all the accounts?
Right.
Does that mean that I can accept that there'll be pie in the sky when you die?
Right.
Which means accept what there is. It's an old spiritual.
Yeah.
Accept what there is and don't protest too loud because you'll be rewarded in the next world for this.
Right.
Doesn't that lead to that sort of an attitude?
I see how it could lead to that attitude. I mean, the argument that I was trying to make was that God, part of the reason, if we can know any of the reason, that God pulled back and allows the world to function in its own way without intervening is so that we will make a difference, so that we will try to cure cancer and all the other things that we're trying to accomplish in the world and create world peace and help people who are suffering. So we are expected to do something about it. And I do believe that that kind of reward is commensurate with the attempt and with the effort, such that I don't believe we can just say, well, you know what, it will all work out, so I'm going to just do whatever I want in my life, and I'll hurt people if I have to, and it'll all work out fine. I believe that God would hold me accountable for that.
Mm-hmm.
So God expects us to make a difference, but it's when people suffer and when there's pain, I do believe that there will one day be like a sense of like compassion, and somehow that God will try to embrace us and I don't know if apologize is the right word, but say, you know, I'm with you, and I know you went through a lot, and I want you to feel okay.
So the family that says, we need a miracle here, Rabbi.
Yeah.
Help us pray for a miracle.
Yeah.
So what do you say to them? Give us a miracle.
Yeah.
And then you get the permutations, which is the one of, we're willing to make a large contribution to the hospital.
Right. So I say, what kind of miracle would you like? Let's make it happen.
Yes, right.
And then we just do it. Yeah, it's a common question in hospitals. It's very common. People expecting miracles, and they could have all kinds of medical interventions keeping a patient alive, and then they'll say something like, "We're not going to take it off because we're expecting a miracle."
Right.
Like, we'll intervene in the most expensive and aggressive manner, and then say that we're not going to stop because we expect God to intervene. And it's a challenge for us to deal with. Oftentimes, we try to reframe. What do you mean by a miracle? Tell us more about the miracle that you're expecting, because the truth is, everyone dies. So do people think that by miracle they mean that they will never die? We try to help people understand, where is that hope for a miracle coming from? Is it a sense of unresolved grief that they're feeling? Is it a sense, oftentimes there's something behind the miracle talk. So often by talking it out a little bit, we can find what's at the source of it. I'll give you a simplistic example. Sometimes we find, enough times that I've noticed it, that when, it's not always, obviously, but sometimes when we have a patient who is very sick in the hospital and there's two children with differences of opinion on how to treat the patient, I've often noticed that the child who lives nearby and has been very involved with the parent's life has a less aggressive approach than a child who's lived far away and hasn't been involved. And sometimes it can be attributed, sometimes everyone's different, to a sense of guilt that, like, I wasn't there before, so now that I'm here, I'm going to do everything to kind of make up for it. And I'm not blaming people in any way. But sometimes this miracle talk is actually an expression of anticipatory grief or guilt or types of emotions like that. And so sometimes by talking it out and helping people to talk through what they mean by miracle, it helps us to actually explore what's behind that miracle talk. And like I said, my role is not to say, yes, a miracle happened, no, a miracle happened. It's more to say, tell me more about that. Help me understand. I'm here listening with you. And as people talk things out, things often become clear.
So let's go beyond this a little bit, if that's okay. Because you raised a very important issue. It's an issue we've talked about. And I'm curious and to know about how you approach these things. Once was a time when people, reached the age of 60 or so and began preparing for the end of their lives, and a heart attack, a bout of cancer, a tuberculosis, and they were gone. But now people live way into their upper ages. Medical interventions continue to keep them alive. And you end up with that circumstance that you just mentioned, okay? Mama, grandma, dad, grandpa is in the hospital. The hospital wants to know, which medical interventions do you want us to use? Which medical interventions do you not want us to use? Or worse, do you want to turn off the ventilator?
Right.
The ventilator is running. Do you want us to turn it off? Do we turn off a feeding tube? Do we turn off aeration? Tell us a bit about how you deal with that circumstance. I find it's always 3 o'clock in the morning in the ICU.
Yeah.
Like, no one makes these decisions at 11 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday.
Right, and schedules ahead of time with you.
Sunday night at 3 o'clock in the morning in the ICU, and you get the kid from out of town and the kid from in town, and the tensions are raw because it's, one says, Mama's suffered enough, and the other one says, damn you, you're going to kill our mother. And they're looking at each other, and you and I walk into the room. You've never done that before, have you? Today.
Right.
What do you do? How do you help us to first of all think about this and help us understand how you prevent that kind of crisis?
Sure.
Please.
So there's a few points to make. I mean, first of all, I won't use the cop-out answer, but which is a partially true answer, which is that I don't make decisions for people. I help them work through the decisions. But in general, there are some basic principles that I sometimes use for people, and I'll sometimes give them these principles and then say, okay, now using these principles, how do you want to interpret it in your own situation, and let people kind of make the decision then. The principle that I give people that I think Jewish values kind of give us in this regard is that we do everything we can to prolong life, but we do nothing to prolong suffering and the dying process. We believe in sanctity of life, and we want people to live if they can. We want to help promote life, but we don't want to cause people to suffer unnecessarily. There is a Talmudic story, a basis for this. Rabbi Feinstein is asking, you know, how do I make these decisions? So there's a very important story in the Talmud where one of the greatest rabbis of all times, I think if they did those rankings back in the day, he'd be very highly ranked rabbi, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Judah, the prince, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, was the compiler of the Mishnah, the start of the Talmud. He was one of the greatest rabbis of all times. And there was a woman who lived with him. She was called in Aramaic the Amsa Debei Rebbe. She's quoted in the Talmud many times as being a very wise woman. And she was in the house with him, and he was dying, and he was very sick. And his students all gathered around his house to pray for him to recover. And she prayed also for him to recover. They're all praying, but she's inside with him. They're outside, they don't see him. And she begins to realize that he was suffering horribly. And she realizes these prayers are not for in his best interest. And she says, God, take him. Don't let him live. But then she realizes his students' prayers were keeping him alive. They were like the respirator, in a way. The students' prayers kept him alive. So long as they're praying, he will be alive. So she says, I have to stop them. So she goes to the roof, takes a jug, you might have heard this story, smashes it down to the ground. It makes a huge sound. The students are frightened, and they look around, they stop praying. In the moment they stop praying, he dies. And the rabbis quote that story. They even say you're allowed to pray for someone to die. That's what's in their best interest if they're suffering, based on that story. So we know that there are times. So what I tell people is that we do everything we can to prolong life, but nothing to prolong suffering and the dying process. And what can we do? Your rabbi asked, what can we do to prevent it? The best solution we have, which is imperfect, but the best thing we do have, is advanced directives. To try to have the courage. It's difficult, but it's important to have conversations with people, their goals, values, preferences are, who they would want to speak for them if they couldn't speak for themselves, and to get that onto a document so that people feel comfortable speaking for them and that they know that their values will be carried out.
So is it ever appropriate for a family to say to the physician, turn off the machine, mama's had enough?
Well, are you asking a Jewish law question, or is it, you know?
You're the chaplain. It's 3:00 in the morning. You know, the sister, the brother, the nephew, the niece, they sit in the room. They don't know what to do.
Yeah.
It's clear to them that this is not living.
Right.
And there's no hope for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And the doctors are saying, what do you want us to do? Let's leave the insurance company out of this.
All right.
But that's another problem. But the doctor says, what do we want to do? And we say, what are our options? And the doctor says, we give the patient a large dose of morphine,
yeah,
and we turn off the respirator.
Yeah.
And the person will die very, you know, quickly and rather painlessly.
Right.
Is that justifiable in Jewish tradition? Is it justifiable ethically?
Yeah. So I let people make decisions themselves. I give them the principles. There are ways to justify. There's ways to understand Jewish ethics. For example, there's another story that's told. It's a medieval story, where one of the great rabbis, Yehuda Chassid, a very pious rabbi, tells that when a person's soul is trying to leave their body, if it's held back from leaving, it causes suffering for the soul. It's called Ma'akev Yitziyat HaNeshama in Hebrew. When the soul wants to leave, if we prevent the soul from leaving, it's painful for the soul. So he gives an example. He says, imagine, I don't know how to understand this medically, but we just take it, the source, it was written in, you know, 700 years ago. Imagine there's a person who's dying, and outside of his house, there's someone chopping a tree. And somehow the rhythm of the chopping or something like that is keeping the person alive, such that if you would stop chopping the tree, they would die. So the person has keys to the synagogue or the cemetery under their head. And if you would move the keys, they would die. And it would cause them to move. So he said, well, you can't move the keys, because that will cause them to die right away. But you could tell the wood chopper to stop chopping, because that will allow, kind of passively, in an external manner, allow us to stop preventing the soul from leaving. So some rabbis have said turning off a respirator is the same thing. It's allowing the soul to leave. So there are those who see it that way. There's different ways of seeing it.
But let me ask you then the next question.
And sure.
Again, forgive me for pushing this, but
please push.
These are questions that all of us, I think, you know, encounter in the course of our daily transactions in the world. There are certain diseases when the patient gets to the end state of that disease, it's gruesome. It's absolutely cruel. In 25 years ago or 50 years ago, that person had died a long time before this. It's right. Just because we have these medical interventions that they got this far. Alzheimer's, ALS, certain forms of cancer. And, you know, that person is either, I mean, mercifully, we tend to put them way under using morphine. But sometimes there's a great deal of suffering even under that circumstance. Is it ever justifiable in Jewish ethics or in hospital ethics to help end that life quicker? Mm-hmm. Because what that person is going through at that moment has no quality, it's miserable, it's horrible, is what none of us would have wanted.
Right.
Is it ever justifiable at that point to give that extra dose of morphine or that extra dose of whatever drug and put the person out completely?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question.
And I'm not even talking about suicide. I'm talking about, you know, is it? I mean, what can a doctor do? What can we ask a doctor to do at that point? No pillows over the face. I'm not doing that. But something, right. Something more medically sophisticated, but something that achieves the same thing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've seen cases of, like, you know, you must
definitely.
See cases like
I remember one time a patient asked me, I got a request referral to see a patient. All I was told was the patient is done. They asked to see a rabbi for end-of-life prayers. That's how the referral came in. I went up to the room. This is a very common referral for a hospital chaplain. So I showed up in the room, and the patient's sitting in her chair, eating lunch, watching TV, and laughing. So I thought, there must be a mistake, because this is not what it usually looks like when someone's dying. So I'm not going to say to her, like, oh, wait, I thought you were dying. So I figured, you know what, I'll just have a conversation, and hopefully it will come out. I'll just talk to her and get to know her, and she'll say to me, rabbi, you know. So we have this whole conversation. I'm trying to ask open-ended questions and kind of beat around the bush a little bit and let's see. And I didn't get anywhere with it. And I thought, something's wrong here. So I walked out. I finally finished the visit. I thought, okay, I'll have to come back again. Maybe there was a mistake. I walk out of the room, and there's a nurse who I'm friendly with in the hospital. She's a very religious Christian. And she says to me, oh, rabbi, you were there. Are you okay with what's happening in that room? So I said, what is happening in that room? I'm confused myself. She says, rabbi, I believe it's called euthanasia. So I said, wait, what? She said, yeah. I said, but isn't that illegal? She said, yeah, you're so young. You're so naive, rabbi. It's illegal. It happens every day. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I called a rabbi who I know is a hospice chaplain, who's like a big scholar, and I called him and I said, you will never believe what just happened. I need a good advice. I told him the story, and he starts laughing at me. He says, oh, rabbi, you're so naive. This happens every day. And I thought, oh, my gosh. And then I found out, indeed. So the question is, so what was happening in that case, what I found out is common and uncommon, is that sometimes people will voluntarily stop eating and drinking. That's actually a medical term in some ways, voluntarily stopping of eating and drinking. And then in collusion kind of with their medical professional, exaggerate the amount of pain they're in and kind of overdose on fentanyl or morphine and die that way. And separate from that, you know, in California today, assisted suicide is legal. The California End of Life Options Act, a person has a terminal diagnosis of 6 months or less to live, they can get a prescription to end their life. And people are doing it all the time. I've had a number of encounters with Jewish patients, even with Orthodox patients who have done this. Now, Rabbi's question was, can this be justified Jewishly? I'll answer it this way. I'm not sure if I could say, as an Orthodox rabbi personally, if I could say that I encourage or support, well, support's not the right word, that I encourage this, but I certainly have compassion for it. And I think you can, from a Jewish perspective, have compassion for it. King Saul King Saul killed himself in order not to suffer because he thought the Plishtim were going to torture him, and so he killed himself so as not to suffer. There are people in the Jewish tradition who have done this. There's a story in the Talmud of a child whose father would beat him when he got bad grades. So one day he got his report card, and he went and jumped off a cliff. And the rabbis in the Talmud said, one rabbi said, isn't that horrible that he did that to himself? Another rabbi said, no, it's horrible that his father did that to him. The rabbis have compassion for people when they do that. And so if you're asking, can I justify Jewish leap personally? I'm not sure if I can justify it, but I can certainly have compassion for it.
That's a wonderful way to answer the question. Let me ask just another one. I'm sure you all have many, many questions to ask. As the hospital chaplain, your clients, your audience, is not just patients and their families. There's a whole other group of people who spend a great deal of time in the hospital. That's caregivers, doctors, nurses, technicians of all kinds. And I'm interested in that as well. Once upon a time, and not very long ago, doctors could do so much, and then doctors said, that's all I can do. And nature will take its course. Doctors could make you comfortable, but they couldn't stop death. We've come to a point where we expect doctors to be able to do everything. And doctors can do miracles. Doctors can stop death. Doctors have, and everyone will go on the web and say, oh, there's a medicine, and I know you're keeping it from me because the corporations don't want you to have it. And if I went to Tijuana, they would give it to me. This is what physicians deal with all the time. So here we have sensitive, good, committed, passionate human beings. We're putting them in basically the position of God. Mi yechiyeh mi yamut. Who's going to live and who's going to die? We put this enormous expectation on these physicians. Not to mention all the paperwork and the insurance and all that junk. That's another whole. But just in terms of the human encounter, the patient who looks into the doctor's eyes and says, what do you mean you can't heal me, fix me? What do you do for that doctor's neshama, that doctor's soul?
Yeah.
And how do you deal with the kind of psychological fallout that physicians have to deal with when they're dealing with this level of expectation now?
Right. Yeah, very well said, a challenge that a number of healthcare professionals face. As a chaplain, as a hospital rabbi, we try to proactively promote self-care, where we go out to the medical professionals and we try to encourage them to do something called Tea for the Soul, for example, where we try to force them to take a tea time break with cookies and tea. We provide like meditation or Reiki, this kind of like relaxation therapy that we try to encourage and even require sometimes for the residents and the younger doctors that try to teach them self-care techniques. Is a big challenge. I think the truth is everyone, but you're right, it's heightened in the healthcare setting, needs to learn how to care for themselves and be kind to themselves and show a little compassion and recognize how challenging some of the dilemmas we face are.
Yeah, I had my own experience. I am a cancer patient. When I was diagnosed the second time, my doctor was a wonderful doctor. He is a wonderful doctor. And he became very sort of cold. And my wife was with me. She's like, what's with him? So I put my pants back on and I said to the doctor, can I see you in your office for a minute? And he said, sure. So we went to the exam room and into his office and sat at his desk. And I said, this isn't your fault. But I'm realizing who this guy is because his diplomas are behind his desk, right? He was the smartest kid in every school he ever attended. Right? The smartest kid in elementary school, the smartest kid in high school, top of his class in university, top of his class in medical school, 3 years of internal medicine, 3 years of oncology, 3 years of postdoc fellowship in a special kind of oncology. Brilliant, brilliant man. And he's losing half of his patients. How do we help him? And it suddenly became my rabbi. I started being his rabbi because I said, it's not your fault. We're going to be partners. How do we help him? How do you help him to deal with the frustration that's built into this role?
Yeah.
It's a very unnatural human role to be put into.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Besides the meditation and relaxation, right. What do you say to him?
I mean, I think you said it very well. You know, that's not your fault. We encourage, I believe, as a chaplain, I believe, because we're required to do this, but I believe everyone should have someone professional that they talk to on a regular basis. This is what we encourage a lot of the professionals in the hospital, that they should have someone professional who they go to speak to on a regular basis. Yeah. And, you know, and then find outlets, that everyone should have some kind of outlet that they're doing things in addition to having a mental health professional that they talk to, whether it's exercise or music or nutrition or finding ways of caring for themselves. But it has to be done proactively and in a professional and serious manner.
Yeah. So after I had a surgery, and the protocol was that I was supposed to see the surgeon for 3 years after my surgery was successful, obviously. And I kept seeing him for like 12 years. And it soon became clear to me that it wasn't for me. He just wanted to be able to touch, like, one of his success stories, right? So I'd come in, like, he you know, he said, take off your clothes. He'd touch me a little bit. And we would share books. We would share poetry. And wow. He just wanted to know, yeah, I healed somebody, you know, because the poor guy has to deal with that kind of... Thanks. And the human transaction was very important to me.
Yeah.
It was very, very important to me. Okay, let's take a few minutes. Rabbi Weiner is here, both in his theology and... The mic behind us is a plug-in, so we'll take this one.
Could you share some of those stories with us?
Sure. The stories that I've heard from patients have, interestingly, been very similar to what you hear in the media. Like, I remember most vividly, most recently, I remember a young woman who was 16 years old. She was very, very sick, and she died. On her monitor, she had died, and... there's something called auto-resuscitation, where sometimes people's hearts just kind of start again. And even though she wasn't being resuscitated, her heart started again, and she woke up. She ended up dying a couple days later. But when she woke up, she told us that she experienced love, and she felt that she was with her grandmother, and she saw her grandmother, and the experience was just one of love and embrace. And she also told us at that time that she was not scared anymore of dying, and then she died. And I remember at the funeral her mother saying, like, what a gift that was, that her daughter had that experience and then was able to share that she doesn't feel afraid anymore because she feels that there's love there. That was, I think, the most recent and maybe most profound.
Conversation and process different from the way your conversation is with patients.
Yeah, good question. The main difference between Christian chaplains and Jewish chaplains, in my experience, is prayer. Well, also jokes. I was talking about it with a Christian chaplain, and I was said, I told her a joke, and she was like, you told it to a patient? I was like, yeah, patients always say to me, oh, you're the rabbi, tell me a joke. She was like, no one ever said to me, oh, you're the reverend, tell me a joke. I was like, yeah, okay, it's a little different culturally, I guess. But I also asked her, and we've experienced
that's
this.
That's the best reason to be Jewish.
Yeah. I can tell you some of my go-to jokes.
Funny clergy.
Maybe before we end, if you remind me, I'll tell you some of my go-to jokes like that I use with patients.
Okay.
I mean, obviously not. See, I don't belittle the situation. I don't joke around so much, but sometimes it's good. But Christian chaplains, in my experience, pray a lot with patients, and they pray spontaneously. Whereas Jews, for the most part, are not comfortable with prayer or talking about God, which is, as I told Rabbi Feinstein, why one of the reasons I'm so impressed by this program that you have, that Jews are often not talking about God. The fact that you're spending a year talking about conversations with God is very impressive. So Jews oftentimes don't want to talk about God, and they don't want to pray. And when they do pray, it's kind of a quick, like, Misha Beirach or something. But I have personally found, learning from my Christian colleagues, that trying to bring up prayer and praying spontaneously, kind of just feeling what's going on, showing them through the prayer that I hear what they're saying, and I'm kind of rephrasing it and coming, giving it back to God, giving them permission to talk to God. Sometimes I'll even say a prayer, and then I'll say, okay, I'm going to start, and then I'm going to turn it over to you. So I warn them. And they'll share things that they hadn't told anybody else. Sometimes I'll say, like, can I tell your doctor this? This is important. And they're like, oh, yeah, I guess it is. Like, because when people, you know, oftentimes, context is so important in life, right? So imagine a pharmacist walks into a room, a hospital room, and says, how's it going? So usually the answer is going to be, oh, you know, this side effect. You know, if a different person walks in the room and says, how are you doing? It evokes different reactions. When someone gives a person a permission to talk to God, it can sometimes open up a certain avenue that they hadn't explored in the past and can be very healing in a certain way. I'll conclude your answer with this. Rabbi Levi Meir, who we were quoting our predecessors, so when I was first walking around the hospital with him, and I said, don't you find it depressing working in the hospital? There's so much sickness and death. So he said to me, Jason, look around. This isn't a hospital. This is an art museum. That was a joke, but that's Cedar Sinai, if you know Cedar Sinai. But then he said, but the true answer is, he said, that you'll meet, the people here seem the sickest. The people here are the healthiest people you'll ever meet. What did he mean by that? In general society, talk to someone, say, how are you doing? What's the answer always going to be?
Fine.
Fine, good. In a hospital, talk to someone, and within seconds, they're crying, opening up their life to you. And it's a really incredible thing. In some ways, people are very healthy emotionally. And I found that Christians are very good at turning to prayer and God. And Jews, when we can learn from our Christian colleagues to turn to prayer and to, you know, to that aspect of us, it can be actually very healing and very profound.
Tell us a joke. Wait, one second. Tell us a patient joke. Go ahead.
So I walked into a patient's room, and true story. No. So I walked into a patient's room, and I see the patient's lying there in bed, and I just came as a chaplain to say hello, and the patient starts screaming, I can't see, I can't see. So I'm like, oh my gosh. And the patient keeps saying, I can't see. The mother's just sitting there knitting like nothing's wrong. I can't see. So I'm like, I don't know, should I tell the doctor, should I tell the nurse? So I say, ma'am, how long has this spontaneous blindness been plaguing your son for? She says, oh, just as long as you've been standing in front of his television set.
That's...
Well, you're another possible one.
That's not bad. I'm sorry. Go ahead. That was either two alligators and a surgeon walk into a room. Go ahead.
That there is simply a certain amount of luck in life. That there's no better reason for one child to be born perfectly healthy and another child to be born with a severe congenital disease. And that really is the answer that you should be giving when someone asks.
Yeah, I mean, if I take seriously what I said before, that God created a world and allows the world to function, and there's nature and there's reality, and there's just kind of things happen, and then I am kind of saying the same thing, that things, you know, when bad things, oftentimes when bad natural things happen that were out of our control, it's bad luck. There are, I mean, yeah.
There's a certain randomness.
Yeah, a certain randomness.
So there's a certain randomness that God allowed to exist in creation. And when you run into that randomness, sometimes it's intensely painful. And so a person says, why me? And you'd like to say, you know, this. I'd like there to be a cosmic order that decided the fate
right.
of all human beings, but that doesn't, I mean, and sometimes we do get what we deserve. But often, most of life is a lot of randomness, and especially these critical kinds of disease and health kinds of things. Some of us are born with certain genetics, and some of us are born with other genetics, and we end up in very different, and that's the randomness that you mentioned. The only answer that I found is that in some ways is the exact challenge of being human. So if there is that much randomness in the world, the challenge is to do tikkun, which is to bring order to the randomness, to bring creation to the chaos. So I was born with a defective colon cancer gene, and when I was 39 years old, I contracted this disease, and then it came back again and tried to kill me. And the tikkun was that brilliant doctors, brilliant surgeons, brilliant technicians and scientists had the tools in my generation to allow me to live. And allow me to live. Now, I happened to live in the right place, I happened to have the right insurance, it was caught in the right way, and there's a certain deal of luck there also. But that's the tikkun. You see, 20 years earlier, they wouldn't have had any of that techniques. I wrote a letter to the guy that invented the CAT scan machine. The CAT scan machine saved my life. Because the surgeon knew exactly what he was going to look for when he opened me up. So I discovered that the PET scan machine. They were building military radar at Lucent Technology, and it screwed up. It was a mistake. They were building a machine to kill, and it turned out to be a machine that healed. So I wrote him a letter, and I said, I want to thank you for your screw-up. Your screw-up saved my life twice. Because of you, the doctor knew precisely what he was going in to get. And that made the surgery so much more effective. And the guy sent me back, I got a form letter from Lucent Technology. I think they were afraid I was going to sue them or something. You know, I say a bracha when I go under this machine. I mean, this machine is remarkable, right? This machine looks inside of you and knows exactly, you know. And so this is the tikkun. So there is, but there's also an effort by gentle, compassionate, committed human beings to bring order to that randomness. And I think that's what a hospital is. It's this huge war of compassion against randomness, right? Some days we win, some days it wins. Okay, and that's how I.
Very well said. That could be a quote.
No, that's how I, you know, and so Rabbi Schulweis taught me to see God in the hands of the surgeon. Because you know, there's no amount of money in the world that the Kaiser Foundation can pay this guy to do what he did for me and for my family, you know? So this has got to be transcended in some fashion. That's how I read. That's how I read it. But thank you.
Beautiful.
Who has the mic?
Carter.
He's referring to the Vespasian surgery.
Yeah. I hear you. Many people, if you would ask them, people who haven't thought about this, like all of us, if you would ask just on a surface level, what does the Talmud say? What does the Bible say about, you know, is God in control of the world? People would say, yes, absolutely. God controls everything. Nothing, you know, like one Midrash says, not a single blade of grass moves without God telling it move. There's a certain theology that some people have that, you know, God is directing every single thing in this world. So the reason I quote that story, I mean, I understand, yes, it is a little bit of the way people are trying to understand a tragic event, but it's a very different theology. So I find it to be very profound in that it's a way of saying, these people were saying, you know what, God didn't do this. God simply allowed it to happen. And it's just it just gives me a different way of seeing the world. But your point is well taken.
Yes, please.
Rabbi, how do you talk to patients who are terminal? How do you start the death conversation with them?
Yeah. My intervention, it might be somewhat different than Rabbi Feinstein, especially because a lot of times people, I don't know them as well. But as a chaplain, as a rabbi in a hospital, you know, I'm really there for people, as we say in Hebrew, basher husham, as they are in their own place. I'm not there to necessarily tell them how to cope or what to do. I'm there to listen to them. I believe that there is a certain level of healing that comes through expressing oneself and trying to articulate your feelings. Yeah. So if I can show someone, I am here because I care and I really want to understand what it's like to be you right now, and I feel for you and I'm with you and I'm not judging you or telling you what to do or how to cope with this, but just as a human being who hopefully in some way represents your tradition, your community, maybe not because it might not be a Jewish patient, but represents spirituality, and I'm just here to say I care. And I'm not judgmental or anxious. I'm just here sitting with you in this moment. That's really the primary intervention.
The great Rabbi Woody Allen once said that 99% of life is just showing up. No, it's a very profound idea. I mean, the idea that the chaplain shows up and stays there and the patient rages. Because you've just been told the worst thing that a human being can be told, right? Or the family's been told this. And there's rage, and there's pain, and there's anger. There's all of these mushed up emotions. And the chaplain comes and stays there and absorbs it all. And doesn't get defensive, and doesn't blame, and doesn't offer simplistic answers, right? You've heard a very sophisticated, thoughtful theology tonight. And unfortunately, you're not going to hear that everywhere. It doesn't offer simplistic, stupid answers to really deep, powerful, painful questions, but says, these are important questions. I acknowledge that. Right? Just being there, that's 99%. And being honest. being honest. It's often the only person in the room, who knows the truth is the patient. Everyone else wants to deny it. No, there'll be a miracle. We'll find the drug. We'll look online. And the patient says, come on, I know what this is. Somebody level with me. And the chaplain comes in and says, you and I know what we're here for. And the guy says, yeah, thank God. Get rid of the rest of these people. You and I can talk. And sometimes they just want someone to say, am I going to die? And the answer is yes. And good, thank you. Now I can talk to you. Because if a person's that lucid, now I have some things I want to say and some things I want to do, and I need your help to do it. I want to say goodbye. I want to review my life. And the chance shows up. This is such an invaluable, incredibly worthy and compassionate, you know, exercise to sit there with that patient and say, what do you need? Right? And sometimes the person will say, I want to say goodbye to my kids or my grandkids. And sometimes the person will say, I want a chocolate malted. No, I'm not kidding. Yeah. I just want a chocolate. Can I get a chocolate malted now? You know, I just want, you know, just something trivial that reminds me that, you know, until that time comes, I'm still in the world. And you just to be there is such a gift to that patient. And sometimes the patient throws you out and says, get out of here, and gives you and curses you with all sorts of language. And you say, okay, I'm going. You know, and then 24 hours later, you get a message saying they'd like to see you again. So you sort of put on your armor. You go in there, and the guy says, I'm sorry I was so upset. I said, I understand why you're upset. This is so valuable. I mean, the reason he's here tonight is because I wanted to tell him how valuable what he does is. So that's the thank lecture you. Was good too. But our community wanted to say thank you to you, Jason. That's
very
why.
Kind. Thank you.
Who's got the mic? Yes, please.
In seeing patients over many years, one of the things that I thought was helpful was a Satan that I had read in Rabbi Kushner's book on bad things happen to good people, which does simplify things to some degree, but I thought was very provocative in terms of the view, which is the his attention to the bridge of San Luis Rey. And he says about the tapestry and that the tapestry, how beautiful it looks, and you can see the landscape that occurs with all the trees and the animals. And from the bottom of the tapestry, you take a look, and it's just a bunch of strings going in various directions, which have no apparently any reason. And he says, God is looking from the top, and we're looking from the bottom. And I always thought that was a very good view of things. Obviously, it doesn't answer everything, but I think that it's particularly provocative and terms of all the things that we talk about and evil things and the terrible things that happen to people. Mm-hmm. It's just a simple way and a picture that you can think of. See, I can handle that. And I personally can handle that a lot better than a lot of the things that we have been told.
Yeah,
thank you.
That wasn't a question, Rabbi, I know.
Okay.
It was profound. Thank you. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question is a little bit more maybe philosophical, but the question of whether God can't or whether God won't or whether God's kind of like taking a leave of absence for a while or whatever troubles me in the sense that what happened with Noah and the ark and the world came to whatever the myth is, and are we not responsible for taking on responsibility to make sure that that doesn't happen again to this world that we're all living in? And if God won't and God can't, that still leaves God powerful enough to flood or to create another cataclysm, and where will the ark be? And I just, that troubles me between the he can't or won't or whatever. It's not
right.
Finite in a way.
Yeah. And then the question is, what do you save? I mean, the story of Noah asks the question, what do you save if this is what you're dealing with? Let's get one last question, and then we're going to send the rabbi home.
Okay. I'm a doctor, retired, and I ask myself, when you when I was in surgery at times, I would say, what would my mentor do in my place? When you're in a difficult situation, you ask yourself, what would God do if he could speak to me to give something of value to the patient?
What would Levy do?
Right. Yeah, because I don't think of God in such an embodied manner. So I think I ask myself similar questions. You know, certain people that I look up to and respect, and I sometimes do think, what would they do? Definitely. But I've never asked myself, what would God do? It's an interesting way of phrasing it.
Yeah. I want to thank Rabbi Weiner for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll...